What does it mean when both sides of the political spectrum are saying virtually the same things? Today on Principles and Policies. Hello, I'm your host today, Chuck Michaelis, the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy and the Executive Director of Camp American. Once again, Barry Sheets is resting his voice. He is unfortunately forced into being in a training situation. Luckily, I don't believe he's speaking, so he's able to rest his voice, but he just simply cannot get time off to do things that he would like to do regarding resting his voice and taking a day or two off. He is a busy man. So we're giving him another break and doing this portion of the show ourselves. I covet your prayers for the completion of this program in a timely fashion that is both entertaining and informative for you. And I also covet it for Barry so that he might get well soon and come back and continue to be the host of this program. While that goes on, please be with us. Now, to today's show, I need to do a little housekeeping from some things from yesterday's show. And that is that one of the things I started to do and got sidetracked on, which happens to me a lot, I tend to go down rabbit trails. I started to give a sequence on what President Obama should have done had he objected to portions of the NDAA, that is the National Defense Appropriations Act. We originally brought it to your attention as S-1867. It is now the law of the land with President Obama signing it on the 1st of January. And it's interesting, he chose a private ceremony to sign it. What he did was put in what is called a signing statement. And a signing statement contains objections that the president has to the law. This is really was started in earnest with George W. Bush. He signed things and would issue statements saying, I believe this portion of it is unconstitutional, but I believe that the Supreme Court will handle it later. That's not the president's job. The president's job is to determine whether a law is constitutional or not and either sign it or veto it and send a message to Congress with the reasons why he has vetoed the bill. To be quite honest, this is one of those house cleaning things. President Obama threatened to veto this bill, the National Defense Appropriations Act. And a lot of people, including the Associated Press, and you will be able to see that in an article I'm attaching to this when it goes up on our website, a lot of people are claiming that it was because of this Section 1031 of this law, which allows American citizens to be detained indefinitely without counsel, without trial, and completely in violation of the United States Constitution. They claim that President Obama objected to this portion of it. And in fact, I am also going to put up a video in which Senator Carl Levin from Michigan explains that that section was not originally even in the NDAA, and in fact, the White House asked for it to be put in. So much for the idea that President Obama wouldn't have signed because of Section 1031, which does allow American citizens to be detained indefinitely without trial and can be hauled out of the country and kept in military prisons like Guantanamo Bay and that kind of thing. What he did object to was Section 1032. What Section 1032 did was basically repeal of the Posse Comitatus Act. What it would allow was the U.S. military to act as a police force. And President Obama, to be fair, did apparently object to Section 1032 that would allow the Army to act as a police force on American soil, which is illegal by the Posse Comitatus Act, as we've discussed here on this program in the past. Now, let's go back and talk about the sequence of what Barack Obama should have done. I started to go into this sequence yesterday, and like I said, I got sidetracked, so here it is. If President Obama objected to the constitutionality of something in the NDAA, and it's frankly, it is full of unconstitutional provisions, but if he objected to that, rather than doing this unconstitutional act of signing it with a signing statement that says he's not going to enforce parts of it, that simply does not cut the mustard. What he should have done was vetoed the bill and sent it back to Congress with a veto message that it was of the same substance as his signing statement, why he objected to the bill. normally what happens after the president vetoes a bill is it goes back to both houses, and both houses have a chance to then repass the bill. If they repass the bill, it has to pass with a supermajority. If two-thirds of both houses then pass the bill that the president has vetoed, then that bill is now passed and it becomes law without the president's signature. So he's out of the picture as far as signing the bill into law. However, that is when the president has the power to intervene and refuse to enforce an unconstitutional law. The one difficulty with that methodology is it creates what's called a constitutional crisis. Because what is basically happening is the president is required by law to enforce the laws as passed by Congress. Once the president refuses to enforce a law passed by Congress, and he is in violation of the Constitution, at least on the surface level, then what should happen is that the House either takes a look at it, blinks, because it is a challenge to the authority of the legislative branch. They blink and say, you know, you're right, this law is a problem, and they repeal it. Or they make the choice to say that the president is in violation of the law, that is an impeachable offense, and they begin impeachment hearings. So what it really does is it sets up a situation in which the country gets to look at the law and evaluate for itself whether or not that law is constitutional, is a usurpation of one branch's powers and duties over another branch's powers and duties. All these questions can be answered in the form of the impeachment hearing. Now, remember that what an impeachment is a questioning of members of either the executive or judiciary branches by the House of Representatives, which has oversight over those two branches. They are allowed to impeach or try people sitting in those two branches, and they are allowed to remove them from office if they have shown that they have violated the highest law of the land, which is the Constitution, or if they've shown a blatant disregard for the liberty of the people in general or the states as outlined in the 10th Amendment. Once that happens, we can really hash out the real problems here, and it's actually good for society to hash things out in that particular way. And it's not a game for the faint-hearted. It's not something entered into lightly. You don't enter into an impeachment lightly, and the president shouldn't enter into the game of openly refusing to obey the law out of fear for the penalty of losing his office in an impeachment trial, because that is the penalty. Let's go out and look at what the opposition is saying, because what we've got is both ends of the political spectrum both saying that this bill, this law now, is absolutely horrible. And by that I mean we've got people like Naomi Wolf. If you know who she is a feminist author, and she's written an article called How Congress is Signing Its Own Arrest Warrants in the NDAA Citizen Arrest Bill. And she honestly did not think it was going to pass. And I honestly did think it was going to pass because I saw the debates and I was a little shocked that some of people like John McCain and Carl Levin were so open about their disdain for the United States Constitution, basically the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments that are basically abrogated completely, and also the writ of habeas corpus, which is in Article 1 of the United States Constitution. Here's what Naomi Wolf says. This is very interesting. This is a quote. Our leaders appear to be supporting this bill, thinking they will always be what they are now in the fading light of a once great democracy. Those civilian leaders who safely and securely sit in freedom and direct the military, in inhabiting this bubble which their own actions are about to destroy, they are cocooned by arrogance of power, placing their own security in jeopardy by their own hands, and ignoring history and its inevitable laws. The moment this bill becomes law, though, Congress is accustomed in a weak democracy to being the ones who direct and control the military. The power roles will reverse. Congress will no longer be directing and in charge of the military. Rather, the military will be directing and in charge of individual congressional leaders, as well as in charge of everyone else, as any parliamentarian in any society who handed this power over to the military can attest. In other words, she is basically saying that what has happened with this bill is something like a military coup. Of course, it's not armed, and there is not a junta sitting in halls of Congress. But what she's saying is that the eventuality is that the balance of power has been handed over to the military. And I would remind you, who is the commander-in-chief of the military? It's the President of the United States. So what has happened is that the Congress has bundled power and handed it over to the President of the United States to disperse it through the use of his military arm. Now, it's interesting that President Obama objected to the use of the military. I think he thinks he can do the same thing using a federalized local police force, essentially. The police forces will be under the indirect control of the federal government as well. And I think he wants this job done by local police and county sheriffs and that kind of thing. He thinks he can get away with it. And now here's another quote from the article. Perhaps Congress assumes that it will only be they who are targeted for arrest and military detention. They being in quotes. But sadly, parliamentary leaders are the first to face pressure, threats, arrest, and even violence when the military obtains the power to make civilian arrests and hold civilians in military facilities without due process. There is no exception to this rule. Just as I traveled this country 4 years ago warning against introduction of torture in secret prisons and confidently offered a $100,000 reward to anyone who could name a nation that allowed torture of the other, in quotes, that did not eventually turn this abuse on its own citizens. In parentheses, confident because I knew there was no such place. So today I warn that one cannot name a nation that gave military power to make civilian arrests and hold citizens in military detention that did not almost at once turn that power almost against members of that nation's own political ruling class. This makes sense. The obverse sense of a democracy in which power protects you, political power endangers you in a militarized police state. The more powerful a political leader is, the more can be gained in a militarized police state by pressuring, threatening, or even arresting him or her. While I don't agree with Wolf's appeal to democracy here, because as we've talked about on this program many times, we don't live in a democracy, we live in a republic. And a republic is a rule by law, and that law is administered in this country in a very limited fashion through the restraints of the United States Constitution. And one of the main problems we've run into is people who believe, really, Carl Levin, who was one of the co-sponsors of this bill in the Senate, is one of those people who really believes there are no restrictions on the powers of the federal government. John McCain, who is a Republican, now Carl Levin's a Democrat, John McCain, who is the other co-sponsor in the Senate, the two men who helped write this legislation, are both under the mistaken impression that the United States government is not restricted by anything in the United States Constitution. Well, both men are incorrect. And the fact is that we are hearing very similar kind of arguments, minus some of the over-reliance on democracy, from the right-hand of the spectrum. Now, this is someone who I don't normally turn to for information. I don't trust the source. But he has dug up some things out of the congressional record that simply can't be denied, and that's Alex Jones. I'm also going to be posting a couple of references to his website where he has dug up some information that I couldn't find anyplace else. I had to go there to find a link to the signing statement that's on the White House website, but I couldn't find it there, so I used Alex Jones as a source for that. And I always double, triple check sources when I use someone like Alex Jones as a source because I just frankly don't trust him. Here we have call Naomi Wolf, who was an Al Gore supporter, probably the far left of the political spectrum. And I would call Alex Jones the far right of the political spectrum, as most people outline it. I don't necessarily accept those labels, but we'll take it. And we also have Lou Rockwell of LouRockwell.com, who's an anarcho-libertarian. Again, another political viewpoint I don't agree with. And yet I find myself in agreement with their protests. And it's interesting that I first saw the link to Naomi Wolf from Lou Rockwell. There are many, many different parts of the spectrum who are singing in concert that the NDAA is a completely unconstitutional usurpation of power, and that it sets a dangerous precedent that we should absolutely be working to repeal. We asked you to get involved at killing off S-1867, which we did not get done. Now we ask you to be involved in the effort to repeal this NDAA law. We will discuss this further on another program. Unfortunately, we are well past our time, and we must leave further discussion for another program. Hopefully, Barry will be back, and I just invite you to join us for another Principles and Policies.